But confronted by large bodies of water, their chemical factories went wild, exploded in the death transformation which produced a dangerous mélange concentrate, the ultimate awareness drug employed in a diluted fraction for the siege orgy. That pure concentrate had taken Paul Muad'Dib through the walls of time, deep into the well of dissolution which no other male had ever dared. Ghanima sensed her brother trembling where he sat in front of her.
"What have you done?" she demanded.
But he would not leave his own train of revelation.
"Pure sand trout, the ecological transformation of the planet. They resisted, of course," she said,
and now she began to understand the fear in his voice, drawn into this thing against her will.
"When the sand trout go, so do all the worms," he said.
"The tribes must be warned."
"No more spice," she said.
Words merely touched high points of the system danger, which they both saw hanging over human intrusion into Dune's ancient relationships.
"It's the thing Alia knows," he said. "It's why she gloats. How can you be sure of that?"
"I'm sure." Now she knew for certain what disturbed him, and she felt the knowledge chill her.
"The tribes won't believe us if she denies it," he said.
His statement went to the primary problem of their existence. What Fremen expected wisdom from a 9-year-old? Alia, growing farther and farther from her own inner sharing each day, played upon this.
"We must convince Stilgar," Ghanima said.
As one, their heads turned, and they stared out over the moonlit desert. It was a different place now, changed by just a few moments of awareness. Human interplay with that environment had never been more apparent to them. They felt themselves as integral parts of a dynamic system held in delicately balanced order. The new outlook involved a real change of consciousness, which flooded them with observations. As Liet Kynes had said, the universe was a place of constant conversation between animal populations. The haploid sand trout had spoken to them as human animals.
"The tribes would understand a threat to water," Leto said. "But it's a threat to more than water. It's a..."
She fell silent, understanding the deeper meaning of his words. Water was the ultimate power symbol on Arrakis. At their roots, Fremen remained special application animals, desert survivors, governance experts under conditions of stress. And as water became plentiful, a strange symbol transfer came over them, even while they understood the old necessities.
"You mean a threat to power," she corrected him.
"Of course.
But will they believe us?
If they see it happening, if they see the imbalance..."
"Balance," she said,
and repeated her father's words from long ago.
"It's what distinguishes a people from a mob."
Her words called up their father in him, and he said, "Economics versus beauty, a story older than Sheba." He sighed, looked over his shoulder at her.
"I'm beginning to have prescient dreams, Ghani."
A sharp gasp escaped her. He said,
"When Stilgar told us our grandmother was delayed, I already knew that moment. Now my other dreams are suspect." "Leto!"
She shook her head, eyes damp.
"It came later for our father. Don't you think it might be I've dreamed myself enclosed in armor and racing across the dunes," he said. "And I've been to Jakurutu."
"Jakku..." She cleared her throat.
"That old myth. A real place. Ghani, I must find this man they call the Preacher. I must find him and question him."
"You think he's our father?" "Ask yourself that question."
"It'd be just like him," she agreed. "But I don't like the things I know I'll do," he said. "For the first time in my life, I understand my father."
She felt excluded from his thoughts, said,
"The Preacher's probably just an old mystic."
"I pray for that," he whispered.
"Oh, how I pray for that."
He rocked forward, got to his feet. The ballast hummed in his hand as he moved.
"Would that he were only Gabriel without a horn."
He stared silently at the moonlit desert. She turned to look where he looked, saw the foxfire glow of rotting vegetation at the edge of the siege plantings, then the clean blending into lines of dunes. That was a living place out there. Even when the desert slept, something remained awake in it. She sensed that wakefulness, hearing animals below her drinking at the Khanat. Leto's revelation had transformed the night. This was a living moment, a time to discover regularities within perpetual change, an instant in which to feel that long movement from their tyrannic past, all of it encapsulated in her memories.
"Why Jakurutu?"
she asked, and the flatness of her tone shattered the mood.
"Why? I don't know. When Stilgar first told us how they killed the people there and made the place taboo, I thought... what you thought. But danger comes from there now. and the preacher.
She didn't respond, didn't demand that he share more of his prescient dreams with her, and she knew how much this told him of her terror. That way led to abomination, and they both knew it. The word hung unspoken between them as he turned and led the way back over the rocks to the siege entrance. Abomination. The universe is God's. It is one thing, a wholeness against which all separations may be identified. Transient life, even that self-aware and reasoning life which we call sentient, holds only fragile trusteeship on any portion of the wholeness. Commentaries from the CET, Commission of Ecumenical Translators. Halleck used hand signals to convey the actual message while speaking aloud of other matters. He didn't like the small anteroom the priest had assigned for this report, knowing it would be crawling with spy devices. Let them try to break the tiny hand signals, though. The Atreides had used this means of communication for centuries, without anyone the wiser. Night had fallen outside, but the room had no windows, depending upon glow globes at the upper corners. "Many of those we took were Alia's people," Halleck signaled, watching Jessica's face as he spoke aloud, telling her the interrogation still continued.
"It was as you anticipated, then," Jessica replied, her fingers winking.
She nodded and spoke in open reply.
"I'll expect a full report when you're satisfied, Gurney."
"Of course, my lady," he said, and his fingers continued. "There is another thing quite disturbing. Under the deep drugs, some of our captives talked of Jakarutu, and as they spoke the name, they died."
"A conditioned heart stopper?" Jessica's fingers asked, and she said, "Have you released any of the captives?"
"A few, my lady, the more obvious culls." And his fingers darted. "We suspect a heart compulsion, but are not yet certain. The autopsies aren't completed. I thought you should know about this thing of Jakarutu, however, and came immediately."
"My Duke and I always thought Jakarutu an interesting legend, probably based on fact," Jessica's fingers said,
and she ignored the usual tug of sorrow as she spoke of her long-dead love.
"Do you have orders?" Halleck asked, speaking aloud.
Jessica answered in kind, telling him to return to the landing field and report when he had positive information, but her fingers conveyed another message.
"Resume contact with your friends among the smugglers. If Jakarutu exists, they'll support themselves by selling spice. There'd be no other market for them except the smugglers."
Halleck bowed his head briefly while his fingers said,
"I've already set this course in motion, my lady."
And because he could not ignore the training of a lifetime, added,
"Be very careful in this place. Alia is your enemy, and most of the priesthood belongs to her."
"Not Javid," Jessica's fingers responded. "He hates the Atreides. I doubt anyone but an adept could detect it, but I'm positive of it. He conspires, and Alia doesn't know of it."
"I'm assigning additional guards to your person," Halleck said, speaking aloud,
avoiding the light spark of displeasure which Jessica's eyes betrayed.
"There are dangers, I'm certain. Will you spend the night here?"
"We'll go later to Siege Tabor," she said,
and hesitated, on the point of telling him not to send more guards. But she held her silence. Gurney's instincts were to be trusted. More than one Atreides had learned this, both to his pleasure and his sorrow.
"I have one more meeting, with the Master of Novitiates this time," she said. "That's the last one, and I'll be happily shut out of this place."
"And I beheld another beast coming up out of the sand, and he had two horns like a lamb, but his mouth was fanged and fiery as the dragon, and his body shimmered and burned with great heat, while it did hiss like the serpent." Revised Orange Catholic Bible. He called himself the Preacher, and there had come to be an awesome fear among many on Arrakis that he might be Muad'Dib returned from the desert, not dead at all. Muad'Dib could be alive, for who had seen his body? For that matter, who saw anybody that the desert took? But still, Muad'Dib? Points of comparison could be made, although no one from the old days came forward and said,
"Yes, I see that this is Muad'Dib. I know him."
Still, like Muad'Dib, the preacher was blind, his eye sockets black and scarred in a way that could have been done by a stone burner. And his voice conveyed that crackling penetration, that same compelling force which demanded a response from deep within you. Many remarked this. He was lean, this preacher, his leathery face seamed, his hair grizzled. But the deep desert did that to many people. You had only to look about you and see this proven,
And there was another fact for contention. The preacher was led by a young Fremen, a lad without known seech, who said, when questioned, that he worked for hire. It was argued that Muad'Dib, knowing the future, had not needed such a guide except at the very end, when his grief overcame him. But he'd needed a guide then. Everyone knew it. The preacher had appeared one winter morning in the streets of Arakeen, a brown and ridge-veined hand on the shoulder of his young guide. The lad, who gave his name as Asan Tariq, moved through the flint-smelling dust of the early swarming, leading his charge with the practiced agility of the warren-born, never once losing contact. It was observed that the blind man wore a traditional burqa over a still suit which bore the mark about it of those once made only in the siege caves of the deepest desert. It wasn't like the shabby suits being turned out these days. The nose tube, which captured moisture from his breath for the recycling layers beneath the burqa, was wrapped in braid, and it was the black vine braid so seldom seen anymore. The suit's mask across the lower half of his face carried green patches etched by the blown sand. All in all, this preacher was a figure from Dune's past. Many among the early crowds of that winter day had noted his passage. After all, a blind Fremen remained a rarity. Fremen law still consigned the blind to Shai-Hulud. The wording of the law, although it was less honored in these modern water-soft times, remained unchanged from the earliest days. The blind were a gift to Shai-Hulud. They were to be exposed in the open bled for the great worms to devour. When it was done, and there were stories which got back to the cities, it was always done out where the largest worms still ruled, those called old men of the desert. A blind Fremen, then, was a curiosity, and people paused to watch the passing of this odd pair. The lad appeared about 14 standard, one of the new breed who wore modified still suits. It left the face open to the moisture-robbing air. He had slender features, the all-blue spice-tinted eyes, a nubbin nose, and that innocuous look of innocence which so often masks cynical knowledge in the young. In contrast, the blind man was a reminder of times almost forgotten, long in stride, and with a wariness that spoke of many years on the sand, with only his feet or a captive worm to carry him. He held his head in that stiff-necked rigidity which some of the blind cannot put off. The hooded head moved only when he cocked an ear at an interesting sound. Through the day's gathering crowds, the strange pair came, arriving at last on the steps which led up like terraced hectares to the escarpment which was Alia's temple, a fitting companion to Paul's keep. Up the steps the preacher went until he and his young guide came to the third landing, where pilgrims of the Hajj awaited the morning opening of those gigantic doors above them. They were doors large enough to have admitted an entire cathedral from one of the ancient religions. Passing through them was said to reduce a pilgrim's soul to moktum, sufficiently small that it could pass through the eye of a needle and enter heaven. At the edge of the third landing, the preacher turned, and it was as though he looked about him, seeing with his empty eye sockets the foppish city-dwellers, some of them Fremen, with garments which simulated still-suits but were only decorative fabrics, seeing the eager pilgrims fresh off the guild space transports and awaiting that first step on the devotion which would ensure them a place in paradise. The landing was a noisy place. There were Mahdi spirit cultists in green robes and carrying live hawks trained to screech a call to heaven. Food was being sold by shouting vendors. Many things were being offered for sale, the voices shouting in competitive stridence. There was the Dune Tarot with its booklets of commentaries imprinted on shiga wire. One vendor had exotic bits of cloth, guaranteed to have been touched by Muad'Dib himself. Another had vials of water, certified to have come from Siege Tabor, where Muad'Dib lived. Through it all there were conversations in 100 or more dialects of Galak, interspersed with harsh gutturals and squeaks of Utrine languages, which were gathered under the Holy Imperium. Face dancers and little people from the suspected artisan planets of the Tlaelaxu bounced and gyrated through the throng in bright clothing,